is Sunday.
Welcome, Sunday afternoon, generational change.
Our regular scheduled programming.
It will be. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter. And we've got a lot to do today.
I stacked
the schedule.
Yeah, we have quite a day today. But our show, which is, this is the key point, is that our live stream, our guest, Brian Kloss, 2 weeks ago, I don't think I knew who this was. Now I can't get his voice out of my head as because I listen to Audible. Everyone knows on this show, like I don't read anymore. I prefer to be read to. And Brian does his own audiobook. So, which I always like best. And it's pretty, on one hand, I feel somewhat optimistic that there is a way to better select leaders. But on the other hand, I feel like we're primates that can't get anywhere. So I can't quite tell where I stand on this.
And now we're and our former producer and friend of the show, John Holder, wants to know. I don't know if Dale Holmes has conceded, but I know that Sheila Sherfless McCormick has been declared the winner in Florida's 20th congressional district. So
I texted her, congratulations, Madam Congresswoman. So she was very pleased. So whether or not Dale Holmes concedes is sort of bygones.
Yeah, well. Do I think that Dale is going to challenge her again next August? Yeah, probably. That's probably going to happen. So just, you know.
I would anticipate the next however many months that she's sitting there to be filled with smear campaigns and all sorts of tactics designed to completely undermine her so that it's ripe in August.
We will address all things Florida after we speak with our wonderful guest. He is the author of the book Corruptible, which if you haven't checked it out yet, we highly recommend.
Do you have your hard copy? This is the problem. I give you the hard copies because then I download the Audible and yes, then I don't have something to hold up and wave.
I have it in the car.
Okay. Well, the book. Anyway, so I just listened to this book. It's we're primates. That's basically, and I feel like
we're going against the doctrine of religion.
I'm always against the doctrine of religion, but I feel like we really have not advanced very far as primates. I'm just saying, in terms of what type of people seek power and why we elect certain people to power. And I mean, none of this is really surprising to me, but when you hear all of the different experiments and you're like, yeah, we really are like baboons or, you know, whatever monkey.
We're certainly unique creatures for sure. And a lot of that has to do with the system, not the individual.
It's
the individual
both. That's the answer. The answer is both, is that corruptible people seek power. We elect corruptible people because our monkey brains like those kinds of people in power. And the system facilitates it and puts people in positions where they have to make decisions that none of us want to make.
And corruptible people, especially when they know the system is changing, like to put rules in place to make sure that it doesn't change.
Well, yeah.
So without further ado, we are very pleased to welcome to the studio for the first and definitely not the last time, Brian Kloss. Welcome to Generational Change.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And it's 6 o'clock your time where you are?
5 o'clock, yeah, in the UK.
Okay.
Oh, you're in the UK.
Okay, so I just finished tea and crumpets, so this is the perfect time to have him on the show.
So trite. I actually did not know who you were. I always feel weird saying that, but there's so many obviously really great people all over the place that I don't know who they are, and especially in this country, and I'm sure you know our education system is very lacking here. So there's a lot of things I don't know. Listen to your TED Talks, and then as soon as this book, you sent us the book, but it wasn't available on audio until I think the 9th. And then so I had to like, because I've gotten where I don't like to, I like to be read to now. So, and I appreciate you doing your own audiobook. Thank you for that. It's always better when it's the person.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I did it over 2 days. So it was quite grueling to read an entire book in 2 days, but it was fun.
Yeah, you did a great job. And what I found so interesting for people, check out this book. It's really, really cool. Because while there is a certain amount of geeky science dumb to it that really explains the experiments, Brian does an amazing job at translating what that looks like in practicality. So like you can see, you know, what you know a bunch of monkeys will do, but then you could sort of see how it works amongst people. I was very, of course, intrigued by the tyrants and psychopaths chapter, but I was wondering if you could, because this is something that I've heard of, is the dark triad of traits. And I think that this is something that we all mention in passing. We watch so many shows like Criminal Minds or whatever, and we say, oh, he's a psychopath. Oh, you know, that's very Machiavellian. I mean, like, but we throw around these terms. But if you would explain the dark triad and what that looks like and how that is pervasive in people that seek leadership roles.
Sure. So, you know, my background, I'm a political scientist, and my background is I used to study exclusively dictators and despots. And then I started to wonder, you know, whether some of the personality traits that I was seeing when I was interviewing people who used to be in charge in authoritarian countries also had commonalities with the sort of tyrannical personality traits, the psychopaths in mid-level management or in homeowners associations or closer to home. And so one of the chapters deals with what, as you said, is called the dark triad, which is basically three, as the name suggests, traits. One is Machiavellianism, the idea that the ends justifies the means. And it's sort of in a human form. It's this idea of sort of very cold, calculating, strategic action in which you're willing to throw anybody under the bus in order to get to the top. Then you have narcissism, which a lot of us know what that means. It's sort of the egotistical drive to make other people like you and can be quite defective in extreme quantities, as we see with the last president of the United States. And then psychopathy, which is whether you're a psychopath or not, which is usually somebody who has superficial charm, but has effectively a broken brain. Their amygdala and other parts of their brain don't work the same way as the rest of us. So while we have empathy switched on by default, and we can try to turn it off with a few mental tricks, psychopaths have it turned off by default. And they can try to turn it on, but automatically they're not really empathic people. And people with the dark triad are disproportionately drawn to power and disproportionately good at obtaining it.
Right. One of the stories that I thought was very interesting, I can't remember the guy's name, the superintendent.
Steve Rauchy.
Janitor, right. And was basically like a mafia boss, a mob boss controlling his little fiefdom. And yet he wasn't very good at it because he wasn't really good at masking his psychopathic tendencies. And what's so scary about that is basically what I've gotten is the really successful psychopaths are the ones you don't know are psychopaths. So how can you address that? Like clearly in the story, like that one, they saw that this guy was unhinged. Most people saw that he was unhinged. And after time, that can only go on for so long. But the successful psychopaths, which to me, I would love to give this test to everybody sitting in Congress. I think that the numbers would be astronomical.
Yeah. So, I mean, I talked to a lot of psychopath experts in researching the book. And the line that came up again and again is that the unsuccessful psychopaths are in prison. The successful psychopaths are in business and politics. And what they basically meant by that is that there is a certain level of psychopathy that can be sometimes advantageous, at least at getting power, not necessarily at wielding power. The studies that I go into in the book show that there is an effectiveness to being this psychopathic individual at sort of climbing the ranks. But once you get there, you actually wield power less effectively. Now, the unsuccessful psychopaths can't control their impulses. So they end up acting out in ways that are very damaging to their own careers. And they often end up committing crimes for which they get caught and they end up in jail. But I think, you know, there's a broader point here that's not just about psychopaths or people with dark triad traits. It's a broader discussion about power-hungry people. And I think when you ask, you know, how do we solve this problem? Because there are successful psychopaths masquerading as normal people, and there's also power-hungry, corruptible people who are in positions of authority. What you have to do is you have to acknowledge a basic fact that I think I establish in the book, which is that bad people are disproportionately drawn to power, disproportionately good at getting it, and disproportionately good at staying in power. So what you have to do is reverse engineer the system with that fact in mind and think, okay, let's assume that every time we have a position of authority from a homeowners association to a police department to the president of the United States, the people drawn to that like a magnet are going to be worse people on average than the sort of rest of society. And so you have to figure out a way to weed them out, to attract better people. And that's a lot of what I talk about in the last sort of third of the book with some of the suggestions for how to fix this.
Yeah, I found one of those very interesting. What, and I know I'm going to mess this up. Sortition.
Right.
Okay, that's the right sortition. And I think that, like, to me, that's brilliant. I love that idea. I think that's really great. But if you would explain, it's basically for people like having national jury duty to help, you know, oversee issues, and you get people that are just stuck doing it even though they don't want to. But explain sortition and how that could be used to maybe help us weed out bad apples.
Yeah. So, I mean, given that we know that power hungry people are drawn to power for the wrong reasons, sortition is this idea that comes from the ancient world. And basically, there was a device in ancient Greece called the clericterion, where they would basically have a randomization to figure out who would serve in a citizen assembly. And that assembly would actually wield power. Now, some political scientists have actually suggested using sortition for politics. They would say, instead of having Congress elected, just randomly allocate 435 people and sort out the problems that way. I don't actually think that's the right solution, because I think there are some things about politics that, you know, having a career in it and some expertise is actually quite helpful. What I do think is worth pursuing is oversight by sortition. So in other words, you'd have a parallel Congress in the United States context, where you'd have 435 randomly allocated people in a citizen assembly house. And every time the House debated something, so would the citizen assembly. And they would independently come up with a vote or a solution or a proposal for how to solve a problem, from climate change to police reform, whatever it is. And the point is that it wouldn't be binding. So the House could still do whatever they wanted, but the point would be that the citizens of the rest of the country would see what randomly allocated people would do without lobbyists, without pressures from getting reelected and so on. And then the politicians would have to reconcile the difference. They'd have to explain, why is it that you came up with a very different solution that seems to be very good for the lobbyists and seems to be very good for your bottom line, for your stocks, whatever it is, from what the citizen assembly said? And that, I think, would create pressure to counteract some of the bad parts of people in power. I think you could do this in business, by the way, too. Like, you know, boards, which often are quite myopic for profits, you know, if they had a citizen assembly of randomly allocated employees, I think the companies would be forced to respond to employee grievances much more. So it's one of the many ways. And I think, you know, one of the things that I was struck by when I was coming up with these ideas to fix the systems of power we have is they're not necessarily rocket science, right? These are not like some sort of, you know, ivory tower proposal that's impossible to imagine. It's just that we don't really try. I mean, we haven't really made an effort to try to counteract this aspect of power, despite the fact that most of us are very unhappy with the people who are in leadership positions right now across the country.
Yeah.
And you were speaking with Brian Klass, author of Corruptible. You know, one thing that I found very interesting, and this is the big thing about our podcast, is we talk about what is the corrupting issue of our time, and that is corporate special interest money in our political sphere. And you talk about the fact that as much as the individual plays a role, the system allows the bad individual to basically take over. It's kind of, as you had had mentioned, sort of reflecting the way things work, let's say, in a country like India versus Denmark. It is very true that if the system is corrupt, it's going to attract a certain type of person that is going to end up in positions of power. We have good people in positions of power in the United States, but they are a microcosm of the actual system at large. And so when people get very frustrated about the fact that not much gets done on Capitol Hill, let's say, it has a lot to do with the fact that the overwhelming majority of people that are there are completely bought by the system. How much do you think corporate special interest money in our political system plays a role in the way that we elect the type of representatives in this country that speak, you know, obviously are who you speak about in the book?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in general, I try to talk about, as you rightly point out, the system having a massive effect. It's the interplay between the individual and the system they inhabit. So a good person can go into a bad system and turn bad. You know, a bad system can turn into, can go into a good system and behave better. And so I explore this with a few different ways. You referenced one of the studies with Denmark and India. There's also, I took a ski lesson with Paul Bremer, who used to rule Iraq as the viceroy and behaved differently in two different systems. Anyway, the point with the corporate special interests is that I think that a lot of good, decent people want to serve their communities in the United States. And I think when they actually start thinking about what that means, what it means to raise money for a campaign, what it means to actually go into the spotlight where you're going to have every possible detail from your past scrutinized and exposed by people who want to destroy you, they start to think, you know, do I want to do that? Do I want to have to call lobbyists all the time and take their phone calls and then, you know, try to get fundraising from corporate interests that I don't actually agree with? And so what happens is the people who aren't bothered by all those things, they say, I'll go for it, right? I'm going to be a candidate. I'm going to run. And the most of the people, it's not all the people, but most of the people who think, I don't want to do that, they're repulsed by it and they avoid it. And of course, we get good candidates who deal with this, right? They just sort of say, I care so much that I will put up with this. And that's wonderful when we have those people. But do we really want to design a system where most people are repulsed by it? You know, and I think the really big thing that I'm worried about right now watching, you know, I finished writing this book, you know, several months ago. So it's a little bit, I didn't add this part to it. But the thing that's happened in recent months is the school board meetings and the local city councils where people are getting death threats for imposing mask mandates in line with, you know, public health guidance and so on. What is the local level leadership going to look like if now the cost of even your local school board is death threats, harassment, exposure, all these awful things? So, you know, I think we have to reflect on what kind of system we want people to be drawn to. And the current one we have is, as you say, dominated by a lot of very ugly stuff that repulses the right kinds of leaders.
Yeah. And I also, when you were talking about Bremer, was that it, that you're on the ski lift? But I remember, I am not the best with remembering names, but I remember the stories. And that's something that I got out of when you were talking about his experience and how he handled things in Iraq versus how things would be handled somewhere else. Unfortunately, people in leadership roles have to do bad things. That is just the nature, because there are decisions that there are no good answer. There is no win. And so when you're in a situation where there's no win, whoever makes that choice is going to automatically be the villain. But really, anybody in that position would have to make a bad choice, because it's the option. It's what's the menu. And I don't think people realize that. And I've often thought of that, like leaders who have people killed kind of thing. I think, yeah, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. I wouldn't be able to do that, but I recognize that unfortunately, people in leadership positions have to do ugly things. And so even the most uncorruptible people would have to make corrupt choices when there's no other option. Is that, I mean, what you were basically referring to?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is something where I think, you know, that saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, it's true, right? There's a whole chapter in the book showing that there's truth to that. But I think that sometimes what we're chalking up to power corrupts as a saying is not actually what we mean. When we say power corrupts, we mean power made someone worse. It actually changed them. I think sometimes what happens is a normal person ends up in a position of power and they have two awful choices. Both of them have bad outcomes. And then they take one of them, trying to do the right thing. And what they've effectively done is something bad. But we say, oh, you know, power corrupted them. Really, they just ended up in a position that a lot of us don't want to be in. And I think that's another part of this, is that in political power, there's a lot of us who look at it, not, you know, even if you have a pristine system, even if you didn't have the school board members getting death threats, there's a lot of people who are not drawn to power precisely because they can't handle the level of responsibility that sometimes comes with those positions of authority. They don't want to have that on their shoulders. And that's totally understandable. But you want to get more of those kinds of people closer to power, right? The people who are not drawn to power find it actually really undesirable are likely to make some of the best leaders, because they're the ones who are going to contemplate these things the most. And the story that springs to mind of that point in the book is interviewing John Yoo, who is the guy who wrote the torture memos for the George W. Bush administration. Because what he did was he didn't reflect on this almost at all, in my opinion, on an emotional level, right? I found this one of the most disconcerting parts of researching the book. He had all these different things that he authorized that led directly to torture. I mean, yeah, they call it enhanced interrogation. I call it torture. Yeah. And the thing is that when I pressed him on, I was in this meeting with him for like an hour, and I kept pressing him on, like, didn't this upset you? Like, didn't you ever think what it would be like to be on the receiving end of some of the things that you said were okay? And he said, you know, it was pretty much a logical legal question. I haven't lost any sleep over it. And I just, you know, I couldn't wrap my head around that. I was like, I understand logic and reason and legal questions, but like, this actually led to people halfway across the world getting tortured. And like, you don't seem to have any sort of empathetic reaction to that in any way. And that really worried me, right? It was like, so I want leaders who actually lose sleep when they make decisions that have negative consequences for people. I think that's a very healthy thing psychologically. And as soon as it stops causing you to lose sleep, you need to get out of power. Basically, I think that's the ultimate answer.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we know we don't get that way. They just sort of get more and more powerful, like a big power snowball that's just growing.
But. And then as you talk about, they will create rules. We see this all the time. You know, you have gerrymandering as one example, but there's a lot of different rules that they will employ to ensure that change does not happen.
To hold on to power.
And that's really what I think we're living through right now, because I do think there is somewhat of this great awakening that you know, it takes time, obviously, but the whole Bernie Trump phenomenon in many ways, I think, has woken up a lot of people who, as you alluded to, don't really want to be involved in politics, but feel an obligation to be involved because they see the system is failing and something needs to be done. And so the citizens that normally would not want anything to do with, you know, having power in a corrupt system feel that, well, you know what, I've got to try, because if we don't try, we are going to hell in a handbasket, and it's happening very quickly. Do you sense that that is what is happening, that there is sort of the citizens uprising, however which way it ultimately materializes? We're seeing a lot of the revitalization, thank goodness. The media wouldn't let you know otherwise because they don't talk about it. But we are seeing a labor movement resurgence in the States, and I'm wondering if that's going to translate into, you know, more of an honest governing type situation. How do you see that happening?
Yeah, I mean, I would like to be optimistic about that, because I think you're right that there is, you know, the last election had massive engagement. There were a lot of people who don't vote, who did vote, and that's universally a positive thing, right? I think the problem is that when it comes to democracy, the value of votes, the value of votes is always good, but it's something where the value or the quality of democracy is contingent on the quality of information that voters receive, right? So if you've got people who are engaged all of a sudden for the first time, but they're being lied to or they're being fed disinformation and then they're voting based on that, it actually won't reform the system. It'll just mean that people who are well-intentioned end up feeding into an already corrupt system, right? Which I think is what's happened with a lot of the sort of stop the steal sort of stuff on the Trumpian right and so on. I also think, you know, when you talk about clinging on to power in order to and rewriting the rules to do that, I think that's where the United States is being failed by bad people, not by people who are in a bad system necessarily, because some of the research that I've done around the world, losing power is genuinely scary in those systems, right? So if I'm talking about in sub-Saharan Africa, when I've traveled around, or places like Thailand, it's the kind of thing where, like, you might end up dead if you end up out of power. You're almost certainly going to end up in exile or jail. In the US, you lose an election, you often go on a book tour, right? Especially, I mean, Mitt Romney is fabulously wealthy and back in the Senate. So, you know, rewriting the rules to stay into power isn't some sort of necessity like it can be in other countries where losing power is dangerous. It's just fundamentally a product of the fact that we have a lot of power-hungry individuals who won't ever sacrifice their political ambitions in order to save the country or do what's right sometimes. And I think that's the real problem that we're facing here, is that, you know, all of these people in Congress are going to be fine. Everybody in Congress who loses an election, if they get unseated, they're going to be fabulously rich. They're going to have nice lives. They're going to have good health care. And yet they can't contemplate losing their seat in order to save democracy or do something better for people who are really struggling. And I think that is so, so corrosive and such an indictment of our political system.
We see that here in South Florida. Our congressional representative, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for all intents and purposes, is the head of the Florida Democratic Party, reflective in decisions that are made at the state level. It is a regional party in a state that, frankly, should be purple, if not being red is what it is. And a lot of that just has to do with the way things are done on the blue side. What I think is interesting, and you talk about this in the book, is there is this, it's hard to understand human psychology, but as you pointed out, particularly with the baboon studies and with the way that the kids were able to discern, you know, the winner from the runner-up, you know, when I think about speaking with not necessarily the average voter, but I think about speaking with the type of voter that votes for the corrupt politician, and our congresswoman is corrupt. So the answers very often have nothing to do with policy, have nothing to do with governance. It has everything to do with sort of an emotional
feelings.
Response. It's a feeling.
It's their feelings.
I remember when she was canvassing in 1992, pushing her baby stroller. That's 30 years ago. But you can't say that to them because it's an emotional response. And I'm wondering how much from your experience And the reason why we get stuck with the type of leaders we get stuck with is because so much of the decision making that is made on the part of the voter is made on emotional response rather than, let's say, an analytical response in regards to the actual governance that's taking place.
Primates.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot to unpack there. And I think that there's a huge amount of evidence to suggest that a lot of leadership selection is not rational, which is unfortunate. The first thing I'll say, by the way, which isn't in the book, is I used to work on a, before I became an academic, I co-managed a campaign for governor of Minnesota back in 2010. I was the deputy campaign manager and policy director for this campaign. And one of the things that was amazing was when voters would come up to us and they'd say, we're voting for you. And I would always be curious why. And one of the most common answers was things like, we like the department store that your family was affiliated with, or we love the ad with you playing with your dogs, you know, these sort of things. And political messaging often really activates these sort of emotional responses. In the book, what I unpack is there's a study, as you referenced in the question, about children who were shown a series of faces, two faces, to captain their imaginary ship. And they had to pick them based on faces alone. And what they didn't know was that one of the faces was the winner of an election in France. One was the runner up. And the overwhelming majority of the time, the kids picked the winner to captain their ship. And when they replicated the study with adults, they got the same reaction, which, you know, first off suggests that face value is actually a term that matters for political leadership, but also that our political consultant class is probably highly overpaid because a lot of these decisions are not based on anything that you can change unless you're going to have plastic surgery. The other thing that I think is worth talking about in the current climate with people like Donald Trump is that there is there's a template that's often latent in our brains. In other words, it's inactivated in our brains for quote unquote strongmen. And the term is not an accident, right? In other words, I crunched the numbers, you know, there's 200,000 years of humanity, basically. We've had humans around for 200,000 years. So we're looking at something like 8,000 generations of humans on the planet. And that, you know, for the last 7,980 of those 8,000, survival was partly contingent on size. I mean, it's just one of these things that's true, that you were able to get food more easily, you were able to find a family more easily if you were larger. Now, I know that's a ridiculously outdated way of looking at things, but our brains haven't had time to catch up. So our brains haven't evolved from our lifestyles in the past where size was actually an advantage, particularly during times of crisis. So this whole wing of this field called evolutionary psychology basically says, look, strongmen have figured out that impulse still exists, that during a time of crisis, you pull together and go for the bigger person, who's usually a man. And that's why Donald Trump manufactured crises and talked about American carnage. And he wanted to be the figure who, I alone can fix it. And to a subset of the population, it was very effective. And so, you know, I think the point here is that we have to recognize these biases if we're going to counteract them. I think they're totally insane and counterproductive, but they're also backed up by evidence. And so, you know, that's the first step to fixing them, is acknowledging that they exist.
Well, the saying is always, you won't remember what a person says, but you will remember how they make you feel. And I think a lot of that is a reflection of a lot of the political leaders. You know, it's funny, make America great again worked. What does it mean? Nah, doesn't matter. It just sounds good.
But is that any different than build back better?
That's the whole point. We're going to build back better, man. What does that mean? Doesn't mean anything, but it worked. And that
sounds good.
And that, you know, I'm wondering, because you are in a country that has a lot of the basic necessities that the United States would absolutely thrive on, whether it's education, higher wages, and of course, healthcare. And I think about those types of normal social safety nets that if we had in the States, maybe the type of narcissistic Neanderthals, if you will, like the Donald Trumps of the world, would not be as successful in being able to cultivate the masses if those basic needs were met. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I was talking about before with this idea of in times of crisis, this is particularly when these sort of, you know, templates in our brains get most activated. Well, if you're not in crisis, it's harder to activate them, right? So I think there's been a rise of right-wing populism in many European countries, but it hasn't taken traction the same way. And I think, you know, it's harder in a place like Norway to activate the strongman template. It's just, you know, people have their basic needs met. Their life is not falling apart. They feel like the state is trustworthy. And so this sort of figure that would come in and gin up these fears just wouldn't really succeed. And so I think there's a precursor to it, right? You have to have a somewhat dysfunctional society for this to work, along with polarization, along with, you know, media divisions and things like that, where it becomes most effective. But I think, you know, the bottom line is that even in that situation, right, even in the United States, I think there's a way this can be fixed. And part of it is, of course, you know, the long-term solution is making sure that people's lives are better so that you can't tap into these impulses. But there's also so many other ways that we can try to fix our politics and amplify good, decent people. And I think we have to have that discussion. I think we have to have a discussion about who the leaders are, not just how our current slate of leaders behave. And I think that's what so much of the dysfunction around power in the United States is, because we just sort of, our entire discussion is framed around what everyone in Congress is doing or what the White House is doing, not who would never get there, right? And I think that's, it's a frame shift where you have to start thinking about, why don't we have, you know, when we look around and we see our friends and family and we know they're good and decent people, why is there this disconnect between the people in charge of us? And I think that's what the book is really trying to answer, that big question.
Yeah, and I think it is something that has to happen simultaneously with shifting what those positions are meant to do. And I've been saying for a long time, especially with regard to policing, and it's funny because you actually use the same quote. I was like, if all you have is a hammer, all you're going to see are nails. And if we, like, say, for example, demilitarized our police departments and policing went back to detective work and investigation and solving crimes, not patrolling streets. And this is where I would rather my money be going, is towards closing cases instead of, you know, policing streets, you would attract a very different type of person to that line of work, in changing the job itself. But also something you spoke about was in changing the advertisements, the recruiting mechanisms to attract people to work. But I think that's part of it. But you actually have to change the work, right? Like what that job entails.
Yeah, you're right. So in one of the sections, I talk about this juxtaposition between recruitment in the US and recruitment in New Zealand, and how in New Zealand, they basically recognize that power in, you know, with a badge and a uniform and a gun is magnetic to a certain type of person. So they decide to design a recruitment strategy to counteract that. The whole point of it was to find people who don't want a badge or a gun and still could be good cops. And they actually had a massive success in getting a lot more women into the police department and also a lot more ethnic minorities who were underrepresented in New Zealand. But you're totally right. I mean, if you get that attraction of the sort of right kinds of people to the uniform, but then the system is rotten, well, I mean, the people are going to become worse over time. So you have to do both, right? You have to get the right kind of people into the uniform, and then you have to make sure that the policing culture is very positive. And that's why, you know, there's things that you can do to change this subtly over time. One of the points I make later on in the book is this idea of rotation, rotating people around positions of authority. And the Metropolitan Police in London use this as a guiding principle. So cops are not partnered with the same person all the time. They often have gender balance in their pairs of partners. So you have a harder time in those situations colluding with someone that you've been working with for 10 years, and you know you're both crooked, and you know you're both, you know, willing to embezzle some money on the side from a sting operation or whatever it is. Instead, it's somebody who's new and uncertain and you can't trust necessarily as well. So you don't engage in bad behavior. You know, I think it's not an either or situation. You have to fix broken systems, but neither of them are going to be, neither option is going to be a solution unless they're both fixed. So if you have good people who get into a good system, that's really where the problem gets solved. If you have bad people who get into a good system, you're still in trouble. And if you have good people in a bad system, you're still in trouble. So it's an interaction that I think is something we have to have. You know, what I would love to have happen, to be honest, like one of the reasons why I wrote this book was I would love to have people who are in positions where they can actually change these cultures and recruitment strategies think, what could we do to make our system that much better and to make our recruitment that much better? And even just if people started to think about that, I think we would live in a much better society. And I don't think that's ever a conversation that's happening in most of these places. They're just sort of on autopilot and thinking, this is our recruitment ad from 2019, let's run it again. You know what I mean? And I think that lack of self-reflection, that lack of imagination is one of the reasons why we're stuck in the problems that we're stuck in right now.
I love the idea of rotation. And I think, you know, yeah, there's probably some jobs similar to like having, you know, random people in actual Congress where you really need a certain amount of institutional knowledge and a certain of institutional memory. And so there does, there is a time when you're not rotating everybody all the time. Like there has to be a certain amount, but I do think that in general, people are on better behavior when they're not so certain that the person that they're working with is in cahoots with them. And I think that's a really smart idea. And it's also similar to the concept of that people are better behaved when there's accountability for their behavior and there has to be transparency. And I mean, ideally, we shouldn't need those things. Like ideally, all good people would be in charge and do wonderful things and they wouldn't have to be accountable because they would just be such wonderful people. But I think that we can't, we have to assume there's going to always be bad apples. And so the system has to be able to minimize the negative impact. So if you have bad apples in policing, which you're going to have, but you have a system of rotation, they're going to be caught more and they're not going to be able to get away with doing what they were doing because they're not going to have the same, you know, colluders in their periphery. So I think it doesn't necessarily weed out bad apples, but I think it definitely puts them more on warning and on better behavior.
And that's why the one issue that we really do harp on is ending qualified immunity, because this is the issue that would require police to police their own. And that to me has always been the biggest silver bullet is if the bad apples are going to cause the good apples to suffer financially for it, they're not going to tolerate it. Because qualified immunity is in place, they currently don't have to do that. And so because of the blue code of silence, I know well, they are not going to do anything to upset that apple cart. But if you remove that silver bullet, which is qualified immunity, then all bets are off.
Yeah, it's accountability.
Yeah, you don't need internal affairs to have to do it. The police will do it themselves. Because when it comes to a man's livelihood, they're not letting anybody else get in the way of that, that they can't control themselves.
Yeah, you know, there was one section, I interviewed Charles Campisi, who used to run internal affairs at NYPD. And the thing that struck me, so there's a story I talk about in the book where they basically, they use sting operations to catch crooked cops. But the brilliant thing he did was he basically allocated them randomly in a way where all the cops started to fear that they were actually being stung even when they weren't. So they would have these setups, you know, where it was like a crime scene where they could steal the money. And every time they came to a crime scene where there was money on the table, the cops would start to think, okay, this is probably a sting, so they wouldn't steal it. But what struck with me, what stuck with me in that story was he's like the father of that, right? Like he like invented that. And this was not that long ago. And I'm just sort of thinking to myself when I was talking to him, like, okay, like this is a smart idea. And like you did something really good to help clean up the NYPD and you certainly caught a lot of crooked cops. But how is this not part of the system in every police department in the country? I mean, it's such a smart idea and it's so basic. And yet again, you know, you don't have these efforts. And I think, you know, part of it is institutional. Part of it is that the cops don't want to do this. But part of it is also just, as I said, a lack of imagination. If you come up with better ideas, you can deploy them. And I think that, you know, there are still a lot of police departments that never do this. They never try sting operations. They never do anything like of that sort. And so, you know, I think, again, we can do better. And the book is, I think, reasonably optimistic, actually. I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit waiting to be picked to fix this problem. And we're just not trying to pick it.
Yeah. And one of the things that I did notice when I was campaigning was that, and I don't want that job. I said it from the beginning that I don't want that job. I just recognize that I might be of the demographic to be able to get this particular district. Unfortunately, demographics matter when you're, it just does. So being a middle-aged Jewish person in this district was maybe something that could be helpful. But the amount of people that liked me because I didn't want that job was overwhelming. And you know, also when you pick people that don't want that job, they're more likely to want to mentor other people to come and take that job from them so that they don't have to sit there anymore, which was what was always in my mind as like the goal. And so I totally get that concept. Like anybody who really wants that job, you have to wonder, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you that you would want to get into that cesspool? Like, I don't think there would be enough showers in a day. You know, like that's how I feel about it.
We're speaking with Brian Klass, author of Corruptible. You know, that brings up a great question because I don't know the full machinations of the parliamentary system, but one of the biggest issues that we do have in the United States the federal governing body, that is the U.S. Congress, it is the only governing body that does not have term limits. How would you see term limits potentially changing the dynamic, as you say, you know, the way that like policing could have, you know, rotating partners and whatnot, if we had a limit in regards to our congressional representatives, our senatorial representatives, if they had a basically like, you know, if they had a clock, do you think that that would make a difference in terms of how, you know, leadership?
Or does it make it worse? Because they know that they don't, they're not accountable if they don't have to worry about getting reelected.
That may be true.
I don't know.
How do you see that?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of the political science, I haven't studied the specific question of term limits, but most political scientists in the U.S. context who have studied it, where it's been trialed in various places and so on, they've sort of worried that it would make the system worse because they worry that basically, you know that you've got 4 years to cash in as much as you can. To make your relationships and get out.
Kirsten Sinema.
I was just about to say.
Stand up.
I just would say, yeah. Where
she
it's
may not
clear,
have a she may not have a term limit, but boy, is she making it clear that hey,
right?
I don't
no,
care
that's
if I, get
I think so
again.
Too. So yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, there are, you know, if you had a good system with the right kinds of people in, then, you know, you could imagine that, like, for example, if lobbying was not a massive part of political cultures, if the idea of the sort of rotating door between politics and consulting roles or boards after the fact was not part of it, if fundraising was not part of it, then you could imagine that that could actually have a positive effect. So, you know, again, it's not one of these it's sort of a chicken or the egg problem. It's like you have a solution to a problem, but the underlying problem is not being solved, right? So that's what term limits to me are like in this analogy, is that yep. you would still have a rotten system with disproportionately rotten people in it, and therefore forcing them to leave a bit sooner would just mean that the cycle would repeat itself. It wouldn't actually solve the problem because the next people in line would be similar. I think, you know, Jen, one of the points that you said a second ago about how you didn't want the job, I completely believe that. And I completely believe that there are lots of people out there who feel that way. A certain subset of them, and I'm not saying you, but a certain subset of them, once they get there, their brain changes, right? Yeah. They taste power. They taste the sort of the feeling of being fawned over, all the cocktail parties, the influence. I mean, that's one of the things that I was really struck by. And it's the same thing when I was writing this book. I was thinking, man, if I was thrust into this massively, massively powerful role, what would I do? You know, all of us like to think we would be above the fray and pristine and principled, but there's also a lot of evidence that suggests that there's actually neurological changes that happen to you when you have power. And as a result of that, some of us, and we don't know who, we can't tell which ones would be most affected, which ones least, but some of us would sort of taste the nectar of power and be addicted. And then that would cause us to behave in ways where we couldn't recognize ourselves before. And so I think, you know, that's why when that power corrupts phrase, which we always trot out, it's, as I said, it's true. It's just a very small part of the overall picture that I explore in the rest of the book.
Yeah. And I just want to say, like, I think that you just sort of gave me this idea of, like, when I'm thinking about the types of personalities that are suited or not suited to leadership, I clearly not addicts. And I never really thought of it like that because as a general rule, personally, I don't deal with addicts. I just don't. I don't judge them. I understand that it's an issue. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I just personally, if someone, I don't do that. And now I can see how that would work in a power situation. So, you know, and that's one of the most common characteristics of people that I meet that are very dysfunctional is they're addicts. So when you take somebody who has other negative characteristics and also happens to be an addict and stick them in a position of power, even if they didn't necessarily want that power, I could see where that would become like very addictive.
And the ego becomes a major part of the equation. You know, look, we supported AOC and I think that overall she is a net positive. I know there's a lot of people who have very strong opinions about her. But one thing that I always found troubling with her in particular is she really gravitates towards celebrity culture. That is a dangerous road to go down because of how manipulating it can be. And even if the people seem like they really, you know, think you're wonderful and they want to be around you and this, that, and the other thing, you are a public servant. You have been elected to lead people out of the troubles that exist in the part of New York that you're representing, not to go to fancy cocktail parties and ham it up with, you know, who's the latest celebrity in People magazine. Like, that's something that I think she is very reflective in the trials and tribulations that comes with being a person in not only a position of power, but she's in a position of immense power because of how popular she is. And so as cliche as it sounds, but with great power comes great responsibility. Do you feel that the way that she has handled herself is reflective in, yeah, there's the good parts, but there's also that bad side of ascertaining political power in the United States? Because to me, I think that there is that good and bad factor. I don't think she's a lost cause, but I can also see where if she isn't kept in check, if people aren't holding her feet to the fire, she could completely go off and end up like the political lifers who are only serving themselves and not the people.
Yeah, well, I don't want to particularly judge AOC specifically, but what I will say about her behavior and the way that you're describing it with the celebrity culture and so on, is there are sort of two ways of looking at that sort of pathway, right? One of them is that somebody's succumbing to the trappings of power. The other way of looking at it is that we live in a political system where there are people who have disproportionate influence in that system, and hobnobbing with them may be an ends to a means. And the problem is, on the outside, we don't know what it is, right? I mean, we have no ability to tell intent with someone. We have really no way of knowing whether someone is sort of behaving as though this is the way that I get the reforms passed that I think will serve my constituents, or this is just me having a good time at a cocktail party. And so, you know, that's where I think the complexity comes in, where you see things that are happening. And the example I give in the book is, you know, Honest Abe, Abraham Lincoln, to get some of his agenda passed at the end of the Civil War, including outlawing slavery, he basically paid political bribes to people, right? And so this is something where you sort of think, like, I'm really glad he did that. I think that was ultimately a very, very positive thing. And I'm super, super happy that someone who understood the bigger picture was willing to do that. The problem, as I say, is a lot of the times people are not trying to serve the bigger picture. They're trying to serve themselves. And yet their behavior appears identical. So we're powerless in a way to ascertain whether someone is doing it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. We just have to look at it and make a judgment call. And that's where, you know, I think politics is so difficult in a national context where most of us never meet these people. You know, we tend to think, oh, you know, I have a good read of someone's personality or character when we know them personally. But seeing someone distilled through a C-SPAN speech or a social media live stream or something like that, it's difficult to know what lies beneath. I mean, that aspect, I think, is always very troubling. And so we can't tell. And that's why I think it's so difficult for us to make accurate judgments of the people in positions of authority, and why we can't rely on that. Instead, we have to make the system work so well that we know it will attract the right kind of people, rather than trying to make a case-by-case judgment on each individual.
How do you see this evolving over the next several years? I mean, obviously, I feel like our country is in sort of a transitional period. You know, you never know what's going to happen, especially with, you know, the pending, you know, policies that are on the table, the infrastructural changes that need to be made. They are very likely not going to be made. So a lot of things are going to happen. We're seeing a massive youth movement, especially as it relates to the climate movement. We saw what happened the other day with Amy Klobuchar, as well as with Joe Manchin. There's a lot. There is this sort of uprising of the citizenry. It hasn't gotten violent yet, but that doesn't mean that couldn't happen. How do you foresee sort of the evolution, if you will? Because I think most people, Brian, at this point are aware that our system is completely corrupted. And now the question is, do we accept it that way and continue? Or are we looking at a massive change in the near future?
Revolution.
So, if you will.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that the system itself needs to be responded to with violence or revolution. I wouldn't support political violence ever. But I think that there is something that still can be done through the current system to ensure that the system is reformed. And I think that, you know, it's incumbent upon Democrats to do their job in this regard. There is a massive, massive amount of trust that's been put in them to fix some of these things. Now, I'm not particularly optimistic that major systemic reform is going to happen. And part of that reason is because it's being blocked by Republicans who have disproportionate power relative to their numbers due to things like gerrymandering and the way the Senate works and so on, and the Supreme Court and all this. I'm very pessimistic about the short to medium term in the United States. I mean, I don't know how else to put this, because I think the trends we're seeing with Republican authoritarianism and Democratic inaction are bad, and they're not fixing the problems that I think really do need to be fixed. And I also think that a lot of people who are in the broader, you know, citizenry, which is to say average voters and so on, are getting bad information. I mean, you see this with vaccines, you see this with every possible issue, that normal and decent people are still making decisions based off of lies. And you can't have a democracy that works that well if that's true, because, you know, one of the ways of thinking about democracy is informed consent of the governed, which is to say people who get information about what's going on and then they either consent or don't consent to what the government does. And, you know, if the information pipeline is broken, well, democracy is broken. And I think the information pipeline is very badly broken right now in the United States. And that combined with some of these efforts like, you know, replacing local election officials with people who believe in Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 election, we're heading towards a very bad place. And I think that, you know, the question that I don't know the answer to is, where does this stop? Because one of the things I was hopeful about was that despite how horrible January 6th was, and it was one of the worst events in modern political history in the United States, I thought it would be an off-ramp for some of the craziness, right? I thought this would be like the obvious breaking point to say, look, okay, we've clearly gone too far. We've incited violence. This is a real problem that people who are conspiracy theorists have taken over the Capitol. It's amplified the problem, right? I mean, and so you wonder if a crisis doesn't fix it, and crisis actually makes it worse, what does fix it? And I don't have the answer to that. That's the thing that I've been talking to a lot of very smart people about this. And none of us can really sort of see what dials down the current trends and the anger and the polarization. And that's why in the short to medium term, I'm pretty pessimistic. I'm optimistic over the longer term because I think Americans are very resourceful people. And I do believe human nature is fundamentally good in general. So I'm hoping that eventually this will get fixed, but I don't think it will be soon.
And something that comes to mind is we spend time talking about how we elect people who, let's say, aren't psychopaths, or we can minimize their damage. But in this country, as you know, the people that are really in charge are not our elected people, but they're our oligarchs. And you've got people that are complete psychopaths like Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or Elon Musk, or people who clearly are about themselves and finances and shareholders and all of those things. And we don't get a say so whatsoever in who they are. And that to me is something that's really scary, because those are the same people that own the media. And those are the same people that put out the information to keep us sort of in this perpetual state of conflict. So it's like, even if we reform the election system, are we too far gone as far as oligarchy to even rein back in elected officials who have good intentions?
Well, I don't think we're too far gone. I mean, I think, you know, the U.S. has had dysfunction in its democracy for a long time. I mean, there's no question about that. But it's also, you know, comparatively, and I say this comparatively as someone who's done a lot of field research in very broken dictatorships, where, I mean, you know, really, really awful places that I've been and lived, that on the grand scheme of things in the world, we're also fortunate to have some freedoms and to have some things about our democracy that do work rather well. So, you know, I think that there can be fixes. I don't think that this is a lost cause. And I think that the systemic reforms are necessary. They're probably not going to be ushered in easily or willingly by a lot of people who are benefiting from the current status quo, but I am still optimistic that they can be changed. And I think, you know, as pessimistic as I am, it is still, the United States is still a place that in the lottery of birth is one of the winning countries. I mean, I know that that's for a lot of people who are very upset about the state of affairs in the United States, it sounds weird, but I mean, you know, Madagascar, I've spent a lot of time in. The average person there makes $1.50 a day. I mean, the type of poverty and crippling injustice is just something that Americans normally will never experience. And so, you know, I think that gave me a perspective where I said, yeah, things are really bad in the United States, there's no question. We're still one of the luckiest countries in the world. So, you know, it's not to diminish the problem. It's just to have a sense of perspective that this is a fixable problem, and that the scale of our issues are profound, but they're not as bad as they could be. And that's, you know, that's the only way I can inject a dose of optimism in the short, medium term, is we're not the worst of the worst by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, that's good. I mean, well, in Florida, we're usually 48th or 49th out of 50 for everything. So it's good to know that our country is in the bottom.
Try to have a good perspective about the fact that anything that we're trying to change down here and it doesn't seem to really move, it's because Florida just happens to be one of the worst places in the country to try it.
But we're the worst in a country that's not the worst. So yeah, you know, it's
got to find that silver lining wherever you can. But that's why we're doing what we're doing. You know, we have developed. A reputation here in South Florida. We are, you know, trying to be a voice for the voiceless in a lot of ways. And, you know, we're really trying to put perspective behind this because there is a lot of hopelessness out there, a lot of nihilism, and we're really trying to combat that. And, you know, there's a lot of barriers to overcome. You know, when things get that, you know, the night is darkest just before the dawn, and we're kind of seeing that right now. But we also see signs of hope. And I think for anybody out there who's looking for an understanding, you know, for so long, like my evolution in politics over the last 5 years, I had always thought I knew things, but I didn't fully understand. There was so much I needed to learn. And I did learn. And I think for a lot of people who don't understand the psychology of political corruption, this is a book that you absolutely should read.
Yeah.
Because it really clarifies what, you know, when you say, why does that person vote for that person or that person vote for that person? The human psyche is it's very unique to unwrap, and there isn't a lot of logic behind it. So recognizing that that's where it is, you have to work with it and then hopefully make it better, as you have obviously been involved for a number of years in a lot of different ways. But Brian, we can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast today. And of course, guys, the book is Corruptible.
Yes.
You can get it anywhere, preferably not at Amazon, but if you have to go there, then, you know, it is what it is.
Or you can Audible. I tend to Audible.
Where's a good place to get your book that isn't Amazon?
Any independent bookshop in your local community, you can order it through them if they don't have it in stock. Barnes & Noble, everywhere has it. So just support whatever business you want to support.
Final word for you, my friend. The floor is yours.
Well, I just want to say thank you. And I think, you know, it's one of these things where it's nice that you are doing what you're doing, because this is the kind of thing that this is what fixes the problem little by little, right? We have people who care, who take time to speak about things that they're passionate about and advocate for a better system that they want and throw their hat in the ring. And we need as many people as possible to do that. And I think that that's where, from community level up to the White House, you know, that's how the pipeline works. It starts small and it gets bigger. And I think that, you know, as I say, I'm a very optimistic person. We have a lot of very profound problems. We can fix them. But it takes lots of concerted action. And with that, I think we can actually overcome this.
Brian Kloss.
Thank you so much. We're just trying to transform politics into service. I mean, that's our mission, is transforming politics into service. Because, and what's interesting is I felt like when I was listening to what you were saying for your book, it's basically what we're trying to accomplish is get the kind of people in office that want to serve and not just serve themselves. So I think it's really, we're sort of have the same mission.
Brian Kloss, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was so nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
Take care, brother.
Bye.
So that was a very enlightening conversation.
And well, so for anybody,
and as I said, I equate it this way. You know, when I first got into politics, I had always studied it when I was young, but there's something to be said for, and I know you like to say going down the rabbit hole, but in a way, that's kind of what it is, because we see our problems. We recognize that there's a lot of issues that exist, but we're not really sure where it stems from or how to actually fix it. And once you figure out how a lot of this stuff works, that will actually help you, even if you don't like what you're hearing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not pretty stuff. But like when I was sitting there reading the chapter called Tyrants and Psychopaths, and it's talking about the dark triad, the amount of our governing representatives that come to mind when you're hearing the traits of psychopaths, I'm thinking, yeah, like absolutely. Like, and you know, Debbie is just one of many, but like, if you were to like, listen, I mean, she so satisfies that dark triad. It's in like almost to the T.
Most of you don't know, years ago, Debbie was asked, this was during, I believe, 2016, when she was still head of the DNC. Oh, yeah. And people had asked her, you know, a lot of people don't like you. And a lot of people do not agree with the direction you move in politically. What do you say to them? And her response is very simple. I know better than they do. That was it. That was her response.
She just doesn't care. I mean, it's just, you know.
And so that to me really says a lot about it's not just the old guard. It's the fact that you really need to be electing representatives that are not bought and paid for by the machine, because the machine is what ultimately transforms you. It doesn't mean that the people who are not bought by the machine don't have their flaws. We had Ro Khan on the podcast and we think very highly of him, but he has flaws himself.
Yeah, well, everybody has flaws, and he's also working within a system that's just disgusting.
That's correct.
But I feel like we do have an opportunity to better assess representatives. And one of the chapters in Brian's book that we didn't talk about really talks about how people who have regular close interaction with the people who their choices affect obviously govern differently than people that do not have interactions with those people. And you can look at certain representatives like our representative or Kyrsten Sinema and people who do not meet with anybody. They don't meet with their people. If you have a representative that isn't meeting regularly meeting with their regular people, I assure you that they're not properly representing their constituents. You can't be.
And not only that, what you'll often have in many cases when you have a representative that ultimately is, let's be honest, forced to meet with their representatives is an extremely controlled environment. They will only allow certain people in the room. They will only allow certain questions, pre-screened questions, yes, to be asked.
That doesn't count, by the way. That doesn't count. I'm talking about regular meetings with regular people in unprompted, unscripted discussions.
And for those of you who don't really know much about what really has gone on behind the scenes with somebody like a Hillary Clinton, I can tell you from somebody who was that we know well, who was affiliated with our campaign and worked for a major union and was involved with an event with Hillary years ago. And what ended up happening was there was an unsolicited question that managed to sneak through, and Hillary was basically boxed into a corner having to ask it. Well, what happened afterwards behind the scenes was stuff of legend in terms of how vitriolic, rage-filled, and downright despicable Hillary Clinton actually is. And while—
raise your hand if you're surprised.
So while that may have been Hillary's experience and is notorious for dealing with people when she isn't in a controlled environment, well, just imagine how many other representatives are out there that do the exact same thing. Everything has to be coordinated and controlled in a certain way. Now, when we think about the representatives, maybe not universally, but very close. When we think about Ro Khan, when we think about Raul Guevara, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, AOC, Ayanna Pressley, you know, Jamal Bowman, there are representatives out there who don't need to be in that controlled environment. They may not necessarily want to deal with the issue head on, but are they going to deliberately lie to you and have a controlled environment? No. And that is, but again, that's a very small percentage of people who are trying to ascertain power. And so what happened in this past week, which is very significant, and for those of you who would like to see Jen run for Congress again, a major domino did fall in our favor. And that, of course, is Sheila Sherfalus McCormick is going to be the next congressional.
Sheila Sherfalus McCormick.
Stop correcting me.
I just like to say it.
It's a cool name.
It is.
I thought I said it.
Sheila Sherfalus McCormick.
Sheila Sherfalus McCormick will be the next congressional representative of Florida's 20th district.
SCM.
Now, what is so unique about this district is that it borders our district. In fact, a number of towns either border or cross over in our district.
We even share an early voting site.
Yes.
And that's the one where they have the
Pinebrook Pines, Miramar.
Well, and Miramar has the best food.
And not only that, but it's also one of the most trafficked polling sites.
Guys, if you ever have any chance to early vote and you're a Broward County resident, go check out Miramar. Because if you're a Broward County resident, you can early vote anywhere that there's early voting. Go check out this voting district because they have the best food.
John, if you're—
there's live music. It's a party there.
John, if you're surprised that this isn't news, then I'm surprised at you. Because anytime a representative like this gets through, they don't want anyone talking.
There's
about
a reason the Sun Sentinel could not smear her enough. And I actually do believe that one of the reasons, if not the reason, they endorsed Omari was because they knew that would be the biggest hit on Sheila. Because as soon as they could, they threw him under the bus as well.
Because they may have seen, and this is my observation, because I even said it at the time, the endorsement made no sense because they never endorse a non-corporate candidate.
Nope.
But we never got the sense that Omari was actually gaining enough momentum to be a threat. And not just, and it wasn't just the money factor.
No.
It was a myriad of factors. See, I said that word right finally. So what ends up happening is they endorse a candidate like Omari to build his momentum because he's the one person who could draw votes away from Sheila. So the political calculation made all the sense.
We see you, Sun Sentinel, for the dirt rag that you are.
See
you. And then the fact that they had that, what's his name, the Trump guy, the rabbi, write that smear piece on Omari, but technically it wasn't from them. Oh, no. So they just allowed the candidate that they endorsed a couple months ago get thrown under a bus by someone else because they really didn't care one way or the other about endorsing Omari. In fact, we thought it was weird and now it makes sense. They were really just trying to stick it to Sheila.
And not only that, well, there was a number of things that we saw. And let's be honest, you know, and again, don't have to name the person because there's just no point, but the primary political writer for the paper, wrote a horrifically despicable smear article about Sheila, about the fact that she was self-funded. But if you read the article carefully, what the article was really addressing, and this will happen to Jen if she runs again, you're an outsider. Who the hell do you think you are coming into our playground?
Well, but it also had a nice twist of racism that I won't have.
Oh, 100%.
I'll get the misogyny aspect. But, you know, this particular hack at the Sun Sentinel can't wrap his head around how a 42-year-old Black woman could possibly have the resources to support her own campaign. However, this same person, and I'm going to say reporter, doesn't ever see fit to question where corporate candidates get their money. So Sheila is so suspect because she happened to be a successful business person that was able to finance her own campaign. That's suspicious. But Debbie Wasserman Schultz taking money hand over fist from every nefarious special interest, that doesn't even get a mention. That is what I would call top tier racist misogyny. And no one does it better than this person at the Sun Sentinel.
And
so
this is a person
off.
Who, you know, again, and as bad as that person is, and that person is bad, but that person at least is extremely transparent. That person does not hide the fact that they are a hack for the establishment. They are very transparent.
Most people don't realize that, though, because the people, for the most part, the people that read the Sun Sentinel are older, still pretty mainstream media people that probably alternate. Half of them probably watch MSNBC and half of them watch Fox, but they all kind of read their local Sun Sentinel.
What I can also tell you
they're dinosaurs.
When I was with Sheila at the vote count. The main vote count. The one that happened the other day was to basically finalize everything. I was at the vote count for about 3 hours when they were basically trying to figure out if they could sneak some extra ballots in. That was interesting. And hats off to a gentleman that doesn't get enough credit because in reality, even though he's super team blue, he actually has quite a bit of integrity. And that, of course, is Mitch Caesar. Thank you, Mitch, for what you did for Sheila.
Did you ever think we'd be publicly thanking Mitch Caesar?
Oh, well, you never know. You never know. I never thought he was a bad guy.
No, never thought he was a bad guy. Never thought that. But definitely, I always thought a team player, like a very kind of establishment person. And the fact that he was willing to be on Team Sheila, that's very impressive.
And it's always nice because Mitch thinks very highly of Jen and Jen thinks highly of him.
I do.
And so, you know, just seeing him there as part of Sheila's team, she had a team of
if there's anyone who knows the filth of our county, it is him.
Well, that's why. And I think that's part of the reason why he was there. And part of the reason why he was there is because, again, we're not going to name the person, but that person was one of many who will do whatever they have to do to maintain the machine. And if that means election rigging, yes, I said it, election rigging, then that's what's going to happen. But if you have a great team of attorneys, including one who has been involved in Broward politics for 40 years, you're not sneaking anything by him.
No, he knows how the filth. But what's so interesting, like people don't realize just exactly how bad it is. I mean, we have something down here called ballot harvesting. Yeah. I'm sure it happens in other places. I'm not saying it's exclusive to us. But ballot harvesting is a very popular way that people that we sort of consider to be like Broward Mafia just stay in power. And that's just something that they do.
One of the things that took place over the course of the campaign, and look, I don't think Jen was going to beat Debbie the first time, but I think we could have gotten a lot closer had a lot of things fallen into place.
Had there not been COVID.
One of the things that did take place, though, that cannot be denied, and one of the reasons why the gap was so staggering in some respects, You know, Debbie ended up winning by over 40 points. And one of the reasons that happened is because the ballot harvesting factor is a real thing. Now, how do we know this? You're like, well, you say these things, how can you prove it? Well, as it turns out, there are what is known as these slate cards. And the slate cards are funded somewhat nefariously.
They're not legal. They're really not legal.
They're not legal, but and it's one thing to not be within the letter of the law. It's another thing entirely when you're literally breaking the law. And the people who were involved in the ballot harvesting component of the 2020 primary, it was proven because people were saying it, because people were showing evidence of it, that these slate cards were being placed in people's mailboxes. That's illegal. You can't do that. Now, of course, nobody got in trouble for it. No. And as it turns out, the person in question that Sheila ultimately defeated, there were a lot of other candidates that were in the race, of course, but the one who was closest to victory is somebody who has been under FBI investigation. And
I think that that is something that is sort of a red flag.
So when something like that happens, you have to ask yourself, you know, how deep does the corruption run? And that's where a book like Corruptible comes into play.
It was great, guys. It really was. I highly recommend it. It was really interesting. I'm really not surprised by a lot of it because I've always found humans to be fairly primitive and we're just...
No, individuals are resourceful, but groups are dangerous. Very dangerous.
Right. That's what I would say. Like, I like persons. Mm-hmm. I don't like people. And once more than one person comes together and forms a people, then it's chaos. But
we saw the effects of that. And look, Sheila had to spend a lot of money on top of the fact that she had already run for the seat twice in a crowded field to win by six
votes. And here's the thing, people, and I said it from the beginning, she was the only person of those people that had the balls to run against Alcee while he was still sitting in that seat. That speaks volumes. The rest of them were vultures like that come out as soon as he died to clean the carcass. And it's just disgusting.
And we like Amari Hardy.
I do like
Amari.
But
the one thing that we were very adamant about, and I was because I'm on the board of the Progressive Caucus, was to say that I understand a lot of your emotions, and this gets back to the book Corruptible, your emotions are telling you to support Amari because he's further left than Sheila is, but both of them are non-corporate candidates. And just as much as you may want to have a representative who is all those things in a bag of chips that you really want, you also have to live in reality and analyze the situation carefully. And I told everybody, supporting Sheila is the right move.
And had they done that, it wouldn't have been six votes.
Not only that.
We've said it from the beginning that this is definitely going to ding into Nick and her votes. And when they endorsed Omari, and again, I like him. I like him very much. I think he's a great guy. I think he's a good public servant. I think he's well-intended.
And as far as I'm concerned, if you don't like the way things are in Tallahassee, and this is not a full-time
job. Yeah, no, you're right. You're right, John. I mean, we thought it from the beginning and that the votes that he pulled were Sheila's votes, for sure.
What if we were sitting in a circumstance right now where Commissioner Holness ultimately did pull ahead?
By six votes.
And won the election. What would people have been saying about the fact that it was the spoiler effect? This was not a case of, you know, Amari being, you know, like in third or fourth place.
No.
You know, this wasn't a heavily funded campaign.
But it was enough votes that every vote that he got would have most likely been hers.
Yeah.
That's just the reality.
And so when something like that happens, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, the left, the non-corporate progressive left is extremely poor at coalition building and strategy. They really are. And this was a case where they won in spite of their actions.
But do you think anybody will recognize it and learn from this?
I recognize it.
But we saw it in the first place.
We did.
We told them in the first place that it would really behoove us all to get behind Sheila, and it would really make more sense for everybody to kind of go behind her because she has the infrastructure and she has the money
I do find it very interesting. And we look back on it now, but you know how bad politics is in Broward County. To his credit, Commissioner Holness was the one member of the establishment that came on our podcast when we were screening the candidates so that everybody could learn.
It was Sheila, Omari, And well, Perry was supposed to come, but then couldn't at last minute. I don't know. Bobby rejected us and Barbara Sharif never even responded. And yet Commissioner Holness came on and sang.
Yeah.
And sang.
And he's, and listen,
he's a nice guy.
That is the thing. And he is,
he's a nice guy.
He is a great test example. And again, the complete opposite of Debbie, because he runs one part of Broward County and she runs the other. She's the queen, but he has his own power vacuum within the county.
Oh, he has his own fiefdom for sure.
And what is so interesting about him versus Debbie is that Debbie is not likable at all.
No one likes her.
At all, but people like Dale.
He's nice. He's very likable.
So even if you were to say to people that Commissioner Holness has a lot of skeletons in his closet, most people are only going to pay attention to the fact that
they like him.
I think he's a charming guy. And I think he cares.
And the truth is, there is something to be said for that some of the time. Like I say that about somebody like, let's say, Andrew Yang.
Yeah.
I don't have to agree with somebody on policy to think that they're a nice person, decent person, use good judgment, sound reason, and would surround themselves with smart people. The difference is in the level of corruption or lack thereof.
Correct.
And that is the key difference. So I can recognize that while I might like somebody's personality, that they also might be very corrupted. Whereas somebody like, let's say, Andrew, I like him and he's not corrupted. So I can recognize, but likability does matter. It just does. You also have to be able to get along with people that you work with. Likability matters. It does. But it can't be the only thing that people pick. Like that's sort of my...
We have been also saying that Sheila really presents herself extremely well. She looks like a congressperson.
She's so pretty.
She's just really...
She's always so put together, you know, Sheila. You should have seen her at the labor rally.
And as, yeah, no, absolutely, I did.
She was all... Like, I'm a sweaty pig. She shows up, and she's wearing a T-shirt. She's wearing the Fight for 15 T-shirt, so it's not like she was dressed up, and yet she still looked, like, so much better. Like, she just... She's very put together.
And for an area that desperately needed a new direction, I mean... It couldn't have happened at a better time. And so, like I said, for, you know, those of us who were looking for certain things have to fall into place.
This was one of those things.
In order for Jen to run.
This was one of
those. This had to happen for this reason. It's not a question of whether Sheila is going to move mountains to try to get Jen elected, but Sheila's not going to work against Jen in order to stop her from winning. And she is not somebody who's going to tolerate any of that ballot harvesting BS that has gone on for a long time.
Exactly.
So if you want to level the playing field,
we need to keep Sheila there.
This is one of the ways.
And we need to make sure, guys, that Sheila stays there in August, because they will come at her. They're going to spend the next however many months slandering, smearing, doing all sorts of stuff.
Because one of the things that you could realistically see happening is this coalescing behind one candidate. Because a lot of people are going to be out of a job. Remember, Governor DeSantis now has his discretion to decide when and who he will replace multiple elected Democrats. Yes, multiple candidates who ended up running. And I believe it's just the county level candidates.
Yeah.
So that's Barbara Sharif. That's Dale Holness. And I think that's it.
It's those two or the county.
But those two, there will be special elections for the candidates who gave up their seats, like Amari Hardy. Now, he may run for his seat again. That's possible. I believe you can do that.
I mean, I don't see why you couldn't. You haven't turned out. Like, there's no like legal, you know,
Bobby
barrier.
Bobby DeBose is turned out.
Yeah.
And I believe that Perry Thurston
is turned out as well.
So it'll be interesting to see what they end up doing. With that said,
we're very pleased.
At the county level, you are looking at a circumstance where Governor DeSantis, if you think he didn't have enough chess pieces on the board to ensure his reelection for next year, oh, it's just gotten a lot better for him.
And yet these people will face no repercussions for making these selfish choices, because they were so certain, some of them way certain, that they would be the chosen one.
Because they haven't cleaned house yet.
And these people are so used to people just always telling them what they want to hear, that they just really think that they have delusions. They have delusions of grandeur. It's crazy.
So we really have to do everything we can. And I hope that Jen gets more involved with Sheila at the local level, because there's a lot of things you can do with the federal seat. I mean, especially things like the community gardens we talk about, and talk about a district that could really use that and really
it's
use
a pretty,
that help.
Yeah.
You know, so if we have the opportunity to really, you know, build behind Sheila's name down here, we could really turn it into something big. And at the end of the day, that's more important than anything else. Having the elected seat, it's more about what do you do with that elected seat? And so now it'll be interesting. Now, I do believe that if Sheila is able to get through next August through re-election, then the seat's hers. And then it's hers for however long.
Yeah. So we need to be very diligent between now and August, because they are going to use this as an opportunity to undermine her and smear her so that they could easily usher her out in August.
In fact, this might even be an even tougher challenge than what this just was. Because who's to say that all of them might not just get together as they did with Biden against Bernie and do the same thing?
And well, and here's the thing is that I don't even think that would work. Again, when Sheila ran against Alcee the last time, she did really well. She did well enough that all she had to do really for this race was get all her same votes to win. And of course, that was made harder by the amount of people coming in the race and the spoiler effect and all that. But she really is popular. It's not like this isn't like she is popular and she has the name recognition.
She does serve her community.
Yes.
And so now she's really going to have an opportunity to do that. And so I can only hope that the goal here is to try to make as many inroads and have relationships with people in positions of power that can decide where the federal dollars go. You know, Rosa DeLauro, who's the head of the Appropriations Committee, comes to mind, and she's a good representative. Richard.
And it could have been Debbie.
Could have been. Imagine if Debbie was ahead of that.
Imagine if Debbie was the head of Appropriations.
So as they say, elections actually do have consequences. And so in this case, Rosa DeLauro is the type of person that, you know, Sheila is definitely going to want to have a relationship with. And the fact of the matter is, you know, as long as he's there, she's going to have a relationship with, unfortunately, a not good representative. And that's Richard Neal, who's the head of the Ways and Means Committee. So you're going to have relationships with all different types of congressional reps who have been there for a long time, but have the ability to move federal dollars. And if she's able to move, you know, millions of federal dollars into this district and really help, you know, she campaigned on UBI. You know, if she's able to get enough federal dollars to do test pilot programs monthly for, let's say, 1,000 families that live in the district, I mean, the possibilities are endless for non-corporate representatives who are there for the right reasons. And so
we just have to make sure that they don't get cheated.
So that's our job now. And so any of the other stories that I had attempted to send you, you know, in terms of like,
I was busy.
Yeah. In terms of Florida, there was a number of Florida.
Well, in all honesty, I moved last week. Yeah. For everyone who hasn't heard the story a million times, and my life is still sort of in chaos and boxes. And so I'm a little bit kind of scattered. And this week I wasn't able to download the book until the 9th. And I've really, between moving and making sure to really listen to the book, wasn't really big on doing a focus on Florida this week. So I'm sorry. I'm sure there's a lot of fascinating things going on in Florida this week, but really all I was concerned about was Sheila winning and reading my book. That was basically what I did this week. Other than try to not feel like I'm living in an Airbnb.
One story that I do want to just touch on before we go is the fact that the Biden administration continues to give airtime to Governor DeSantis. And that is ultimately what will be their downfall, because as much as everyone is all caught up in the pending Trump decision and what ultimately happens there, the only person who can stop Trump is DeSantis. And that goes for anybody else who ends up running. So the presidency, in my opinion, right now, as things stand, is going to be decided between the two titans in the GOP. And the more that but maybe the calculation on the Biden administration
they
is
don't
that
care
they want to get that they want to face DeSantis.
They do.
I think that's a horrific decision.
No, they don't care. Just like Nancy Pelosi didn't care that it was Trump. They are best served. The corporate establishment is best served on the Democratic side by having a Republican in office. They like that. They get to be MIC resistance. They get to not do anything. They get to keep and they get to fundraise hand over fist. Oh, look at the big bad Trump. So it does make sense. When I see them giving airtime to DeSantis and basically rolling out a red carpet for him, I don't think it's unintentional. I think that there are a lot of strategists there that think, yeah, this is who we're facing anyway. Let's, this is what's going to happen. Let's just calculate how we best get out of this. And I mean, I don't see any universe wherein Biden would beat him.
You're not going to beat DeSantis at the political game. You can't do it. So maybe, and again, this is a reflection of the fact that Florida, for all intents and purposes, is a red state. And we are not anti-immigrant, but we're strict immigrant. And so when the migrants are being sent by the Biden administration to Florida, so DeSantis's response is, why don't we send them to Delaware? And so everyone's like, well, that's interesting. Yeah, well, again, that's where Biden's from. How come he has to send them here? How come he can't send them there?
Yeah, I find all of this extremely distasteful. And I would like to say we're not just... We have one of the worst places as far as immigration goes, because we base how we treat people based on nationality, not based on nuance or situation. So, and people who are here know clearly that Cubans get the red carpet and Haitians get sent back on like a float.
And that all has to do with where their political leanings tend to be. And so everything has become so hyper-partisan and is a political game that will only continue to get worse unless we really start building these grassroots coalitions. And that's why, like I said, Sheila's victory is so significant. Many people may not recognize it right now. And she may not be, maybe not be a member of the squad, who knows? But what we do
I don't think anybody needs to be a member of anything.
No. What I think she is a public servant who has done extremely well for herself and her life. And she knows just how devastating things are for the people in her district, not just her town of Miramar, but all throughout South Florida.
Sheila's extremely policy wonk too. Mm-hmm. She really is. She's very, very, very smart, very academically inclined. And she really understands things like policy and how they affect people. But I don't see her as like joining a squad. That's not really her thing. And I'm not really a joiner. But I think Sheila is somebody who has honor and integrity and will do the best she can with what she has. And really, isn't that what we want from our representatives?
John, under no circumstances am I watching.
Yeah, that's the thing, John. I can't. The fact that there's even such a thing makes me sick. I couldn't even get through a minute of watching anything about Mayo Pete.
And again, the reason they're doing this documentary is pretty clear, because the Democratic establishment is much worse than the Republican establishment in terms of their political gamesmanship. They are extremely transparent. They do not hide the fact that they are going to try to force feed a Kamala Pete ticket, whichever direction that goes in, 1A, 1B.
Doesn't really matter. Does it matter?
The other.
They're both bad. Neither of them can win.
Which ultimately is a great thing, because if you're only a year into the Biden presidency and you're already deciding which direction you're going to take the party in the likelihood that Biden doesn't run again, this actually makes it very easy for the non-corporate left to figure out if they're going to have a viable challenger. And the only way it would work in 24 is if there is only one, because that's the only way it can happen. When a lot of other candidates, now look, a lot of candidates who ran and were, let's say, on the non-corporate left and ultimately were votes that could have been taken from Bernie, as long as those candidates eventually coalesce behind a candidate like Bernie, and for those who don't know, you could say whatever you want about Andrew Yang, but it's not what you think. Let's just put it that way.
And everyone's like, why didn't he endorse Bernie?
It's not that way.
Bernie didn't want him to.
Yeah.
People just can't wrap their heads around this. People just think they know what happened. It's not so simple. It wasn't like Andrew Yang just said, yeah, I'm much more for Biden than Bernie. That's not at all what happened.
Once you're on the inside and you know things that go on.
He wanted to endorse Bernie and was told by Bernie, no. Because at that point,
UBI looks pretty damn good right about now. And guess what? There were three main issues that Sheila ran for Congress on. She ran on a living wage, she ran on Medicare for all, but she really ran on UBI. And that mattered to her district. It's one of the reasons why one of the, if not maybe the most influential member of the Black community, Dave Chappelle, supported Andrew Yang, because he supports UBI. And so for people who actually know what the Black community needs, listen to them.
Cut the check. Cut the check.
If you're not going to pass reparations, then pass UBI. pass something that allows abject poverty to end or at least be alleviated in the areas that need it the most. And so that's why I think these pilot programs can work out extremely well. Yeah. And so I again, it is kind of, you don't really know how to react. I mean, obviously there's still certain pending elements that could transpire for Sheila, but overall, especially from our perspective, for those of you who do want to see Jen run against Debbie one more time, this was a domino that frankly needed to fall, and it fell. And so now it's a matter of making sure, you know, what happens over the next year, year and a half, and then ultimately figure out if it's worth going again. But this was a domino that needed to fall, and we're extremely grateful that it did. So we are going to take a break for a half an hour because we have another podcast coming up and we need to eat lunch.
Well, we're not doing a we're not having a podcast. We're going on, Fire Breathing Rob, but I don't know where the link is to that. Do we have a link for it? Because I hope so. And then at 3 o'clock, we're going on Reset Race with the John Brown leftists, which I'm very looking forward to because they're better than the leftists that shall not be named.
Who's the prettiest girl? I know. It's you. It's Lulu. And then, of course, at 3 o'clock.
I just said that. We're going on with the Reset Race with the John Brown leftists. I just said. But yeah, we're going on with Fire Breathing Rob. But I don't know. Oh, sorry. There we go. But I don't know where that link is. So, but anyway, guys, what do we have coming up on Wednesday?
So on Wednesday, we will be interviewing our second congressional representative, Woo-hoo! Marie Newman, who is running for Congress again, but she's running in a new district. Wonderful thing about the Illinois, I don't think it's a gerrymandering problem in Illinois, as far as I know. But her district, is changing.
They're wanting to get, they're wanting the out district. They're wanting to district her out.
Of course they do, because she's non-corporate.
Right. So they're wanting to district her out. And the way that they're doing that is by gerrymandering. That is what they're doing. They put her in the district with someone that she would. This is how they do this.
But we're also going to have on Harvey Kay, from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. That's going to be an interesting conversation. And he's going to talk about, we're going to be discussing the infrastructure bill, but we're really going to be discussing the issues that exist within these bills that are just filled with more and more pork every time, because it's not really about serving people. It's about serving corporate interests. And we have to get out of this mindset that, well, we should accept our crumbs because crumbs is better than nothing. No.
We're going to be inspired to be radicals.
Yeah.
You have the book or I have the book. I have that book. Mm. I have that hard copy book. That one's not on Audible. I'm forced to read it.
Oh, you poor thing. So.
I prefer to be read to.
We're very excited to have on Mr. K. His associate professor is also going to be joining us, John Sullivan, I believe is his name. And so that will be an enlightening conversation. We are going to have Jordan Chariton coming back on the podcast, possibly next Sunday. He obviously is going through a major transitional period with status quo right now. So we will talk to him about that.
He is. What's going on? Oh, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
Okay.
We won't talk about it now.
Okay.
Ashami, I don't want to say her name wrong, but the lovely lady, Ashami is her first name. She is, Steph, I believe is her last name. She is running for Congress in New York's 10th district against none other than Jerry Nadler. Ugh. This was Lindsay Boylan's district. And Ashami has already raised a lot of money. She has done an amazing job so far. So we are excited to have her come on the podcast. So we've got a lot going on. And of course,
exciting stuff.
We're going to have to figure out what our pre-Thanksgiving event is going to be. But we have some great events coming up with the mobile school pantry.
Yeah, we'll be doing the gobble giveaway again.
So that'll, I believe that's going to be this Thursday.
I got to tell you, this week. This year I was kind of lazy about the donations because normally I'm like kind of very specific about stuff. But because when we moved and you cleaned out the pantry, I took the whole box of donations to Graham's school because they're doing the harvest drive at his school. And the easier... I was already driving through that carpool anyway. Jason had it in the car. I just left the boxes there. So there definitely wasn't as much thought to my food donations this year. The big box, whole thing went to his school.
We really appreciate it, Jeffrey. Obviously, we do the best we can with the suppression. It is unfortunate. We get Look, I have watched it every day. We get subscribers unsubscribed
every day. So you guys got to keep resubscribing. But we get good guests. And if people weren't aware, Thursday night, we spoke with Oliver Stone.
Go check that one out. Check out our podcast.
It was really, really cool.
Check out our podcast with Stella Morris and Rania Kallik. Check out our podcast with Scott Santons. We've had a lot of great guests.
We've had a lot of good guests lately.
And we're going to have our next congressional representative.
I'm very excited
about
that.
And we will speak, to Marie about Sheila and give her the 411 about what it's going to be like to having another ally on Capitol Hill. Maybe they have projects.
She and I have to talk Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, that'll be part of the conversation.
I just can't with that woman.
So we're going to go grab a bite, but we will be back with Fire Breathing Raw podcast at 2. And then if you want to check us out at 3 o'clock,
we're on Reset Race
John Brown Leftist.
No, it's the Reset Race is the channel.
Okay.
And it's the John Brown Leftist is the group we're talking with on the Reset Race show.
Okay, we'll leave it to Jen to explain it better.
Reset Race is the name of the podcast. We will be on there at 3 with Sam. And I don't know who else is on there with her that's not just part of the John Brown.
Oh, it'll be fun.
We're going to meet all new people.
And we will see you on Generational Change on Wednesday.
Bye, all.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.